Welcome to the TrustVista Talk podcast, where we engage with senior asset managers and advisors across a broad range of topics. TrustVista is the leading outsourcing firm for the financial services industry, supporting over 1,000 clients with over $10 trillion in assets under management.
Hello, this is Abhilash Jaykumar, co-founder and managing director of TrustVista. Welcome to this edition of TrustVista Talk. Today's guest is Stephen Nelson, CEO of the Institutional Limited Partners Association, or ILPA. Steve has over 20 years of global experience serving endowments, foundations, pensions, and family offices at Cambridge Associates previously, where he was the chief operating officer and held numerous leadership roles during his time there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Abhi. Good to see you.
Likewise. And you know, before we talk about what you've been up with ILPA and how the world has changed in the last several months, if we could take a step back, you know, you've had an interesting career even within Cambridge, where you were heading up the investment advisory practice in Asia Pacific. Can you make us maybe take us back a little bit and talk about how, you know, you've led a team in Asia and have come back to the US and, you know, how this ties into your world experience?
Sure, that'd be great. I had the incredible good fortune of stumbling on to Cambridge Associates just after graduating from university, not really sure what I wanted to do, but knowing that investments interested me. And after spending a little time with the folks at Cambridge, just felt like there was an incredible intersection there between doing good and doing interesting work as well. Always expected that I would return to school, but after a couple of years with Cambridge, had the opportunity to relocate to Singapore to help open up an office there for them. Again, expecting that it would be a couple of years, an amazing experience personally and professionally, and then back and on to the next. And that stretched from 2 years to 8 years, happily so, and returned to the U.S. after that in 2008, had a chance to at that point help co-lead the consulting practice for Cambridge as a whole. So you know, had a really remarkable, unexpected run at Cambridge, and got to see the business, the clients, the private equity markets from a whole host of different angles. And you know, one of the things that was most rewarding about the time there was just the diversity of work. And so being able to build and lead a team, as you mentioned, Abhi, in Singapore, come back, have a chance to get involved with other aspects of the business, data, reporting, everything that we were doing from a technology perspective, incredible education and incredible vantage points. So I feel really fortunate to have spent the time that I did with Cambridge.
Yeah, you know, I think you and I are around the same vintage. And back when we started, private equity wasn't a household phrase as it is today. And you almost didn't use the word industry when you talked about private equity. I remember, you know, even investment banking, the first time I heard the word iBanking, I thought maybe it meant internet banking. You know, even the internet was new around that.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, what were you studying? How did you actually get into this world straight away? You know, for a lot of people getting into the private equity world, it's usually, you know, step function, you do banking, you do something, you get interested to it. How did you initially get into this world?
Yeah, again, I think a story primarily of people, which is really fitting given the industry that we work in. But, you know, I had the idea that I would love to be involved in sort of longer term institutional style investing. Didn't think I was particularly well suited to an iBanking career or a strategy consulting position. And as I started to ask around who does this sort of thing, was introduced to Cambridge. And, you know, the combination of nonprofits and a focus really on endowments and foundations, together with these highly sophisticated investment programs, a global perspective, it just was incredibly appealing. And to your point, I didn't really know at that time what I was getting into, but just knew that it was interesting and might present all sorts of opportunities to grow in this area. So you know, really relying on sort of networks and word of mouth and friends and a lot of help along the way from those that were, you know, doing similar sort of things and had a view on the market.
Yeah, and you've had a very interesting view, obviously, from the vantage of being at Cambridge over such a long period of time, seeing the evolution of this industry in both in terms of sophistication as well as reach and getting cross-border. You know, what thoughts can you share as to how you've seen the world evolve and how it's very different from what it was 20 years ago, even 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's at the risk of dating ourselves a little bit, I think the change that we've seen over the past 20, you know, plus years is pretty remarkable. And if we just think about the private markets in particular, the scale, the velocity, the diversity of strategies, the way in which general partners have institutionalized their business, professionalized those operations, elevated the practice of private equity is quite incredible. Sort of stepping back and looking at it over a couple of decades, I also think that the globalization of the industry is pretty amazing as well. And that's obviously not entirely unique to private equity, but I do think it is noteworthy. Thinking back to the first trip out to Asia on behalf of Cambridge and the types of investments that were being made, the types of GPs that were being organized at that time. I mean, it was emerging markets and then some, and that's no judgment on the quality of the people or the desire that they show, just the stage of development. And to see what we now have in China, in India, in some of these other markets around the world that didn't really exist in any material form, 20, 25, 30 years ago for sure, and the leaps and bounds with which they've grown and elevated the practice, it's hard to sort of overstate just how far we've come.
One of the interesting dynamics we've seen over the years, and we have a lot of GPs in emerging markets, typically you don't need as much capital to be a big player, right? $100 million goes a lot farther in an emerging economy than it would in the US. But so from a fundraising perspective, LP access, a very large LP wants to put a lot of capital to work. How have you helped large LPs get access to emerging markets if a lot of the products don't create, big checks where they can deploy meaningful amounts of capital?
Yeah, the short answer is it's a challenge. For investors of a certain scale, it's just not easy. Even if you have the appetite, the interest, the willingness to do the hard work required to deepen an understanding of a particular market and a set of emerging GPs. So there are a variety of ways of going about it. I'm not sure there's any one answer that has generated the best results. You see, there are a number of either, emerging manager or emerging markets, pooled vehicles, fund of funds that exist for dedicated outsourced strategies to tap into those markets at a scale that makes sense for some of these institutions that can't write those individual checks at the size that makes sense. You also see folks carving out a portion of their overall program dedicated to seeding some of these managers with the hope and expectation that, some of those managers will be wildly successful and some of those markets will continue to develop further. And so the size and scale available for future investments will increase and create a slightly different dynamic going forward. But, I think the reality is that continues to be a work in progress if you look across some of the markets that are just smaller in nature.
Yeah, and if we can switch gears a little bit now. So you have this wealth of experience with Cambridge. And about 2.5 years ago, you moved over to become the CEO of ILPA. Can you share with us a little bit what the mission of ILPA is, what it was when you joined, and what it is now?
Yeah, happy to. And it's a pretty simple and I think at least to me, compelling mission. And fundamentally, the objective is to make sure that we help empower, connect, elevate limited partners around the world and help put them in a position where they can invest with greater confidence and generate even more attractive investment outcomes than they are today. And we do, you know, serve limited partners exclusively. I think that, you know, puts us in a somewhat unique and privileged position as a result. And we do a variety of things in service of that mission. And it hasn't changed all that much. The organization has grown considerably. And so today we're in the neighborhood of 550 members, and that represents a global LP base sitting in over 50 countries and, you know, north of $2 trillion in private equity assets under management. So the playing field, the window onto the LP community that we have, we don't take that for granted, but it puts us in a position where we really do have a chance to see the markets from a unique spot.
And one of the powerful tools ILPA has created is the templates for reporting across various parameters. And, you know, we work with smaller, lower middle market GPs, higher upper middle market GPs, as well as big buyout firms. And one of the things we've observed is as folks graduate from smaller funds to larger funds, they attract a new class of LPs. And often they don't know what it is they're supposed to show. You know, the H&Is and family offices have a certain expectation of information, and institutional LPs have a different expectation. And the templates have actually helped a lot of GPs understand, okay, oh, this is what my LPs want to see. I'm happy to show them if I just know. And more so, if LPs agree on, we want to see these things, and we all agree we want to see these things, it makes it a lot easier for GPs to produce. What was the evolution of developing this template? What was the process ILPA used to, you know, create consensus for what actually goes into it? And
yeah,
as you keep producing templates.
Yeah, years in the making, for sure. And, you know, an ongoing process. So part of what we're trying to do is ensure that those templates, those standard documents are as useful to the industry as possible. And the more they're utilized, the greater the adoption, you know, hopefully the more efficiency and time savings accrues to all involved. So, you know, that work really dates back a number of years in terms of the core reporting template. We've released some other documents in the more recent past. But that whole area of standards and best practices really is core to the ILPA mission. So whether that's the principles document that we put out, which really covers our guidance across, you know, just about any aspect of the industry that is core to its functioning. The reporting templates, the due diligence questionnaire, the model documents, a model limited partnership agreement, which we released last year and updated this year. We're just in the process of completing a model NDA for the industry. So to the question about consensus, the short answer there is it's really, really hard. It takes an awful lot of effort, and our team deserves a ton of credit for the patience and persistence that they show in getting us to an end result. But, you know, we do have an incredibly generous and engaged group of limited partners that we work with on this score. And the exchange of ideas and information, the ongoing communication with our members, despite the size of the membership base, that's a really active a two-way conversation. So we benefit tremendously from that. And I just offer, you know, that I think one of the areas in which we can continue as ILPA to do an even better job is the interactions with the rest of the PE stakeholder community, and making sure that when we do see an opportunity to push forward on some of these standards and practices that we think genuinely will benefit all, that we do even more to build out that coalition to make sure that there are a variety of viewpoints that that are shared as we pull those things together. So I think, you know, that will be part and parcel of how we approach these things going forward.
Yeah, and as you know, we're partners with Open, big champions of you know, what you do, and try to educate a lot of our GP clients on the best practices that ILPA promotes. And we've seen a lot of our GPs very receptive to the idea of producing template reports. But this is a double-edged sword for LPs as well. They've asked for information for a long time. Now all of a sudden they're getting more than they've ever gotten before. So it's like drinking from a fire hose. So we're seeing a lot of LPs leaning on us just to try to organize this data. How have you seen LPs actually use the increased data and transparency to be better investors?
Yeah, I would say just as a general rule, data-driven decision-making has increased substantially, become a much more important aspect of the due diligence evaluation and decision-making process. And that's not to say that folks weren't invested in those efforts earlier. I just think, you know, combination of data availability, data reliability, and then the tools, the systems through which all of that can be analyzed and insights ultimately gleaned. That spectrum hadn't really taken hold yet. And so I think what we now have is an industry where, as you say, data is much more available. It is coming in a form that can be consumed by LPs. And I think what we've seen amongst our members is they are continuing to evaluate their data needs, aiming for as much consistency and efficiency there as possible, also continuing to evaluate the technology tools that they rely on, and then thinking about what are the skill sets that they need in-house to be able to do everything that they would like to do with that data. But I will say that it's not uncommon for us to hear from the GP community, we're providing all of this data, and, you know, pick a data type, any data type, we're providing this data. It's really unclear to us how it's actually filtering its way through internally with LPs. And we just want to be assured that it's making a difference, it's having an impact, and it's genuinely needed. I'll just say on behalf of the LP community, it is. It's really important. The progress that we've made is critical. We need to, you know, not only maintain that, but push even further ahead. And as LPs, I think we continue to need to be able to articulate exactly how it's making its way into final decision making.
Yeah, you know, if you look back decades and decades of how investing is done, right, the volume of information investors have access to has been growing exponentially, but investing as an industry is not better than it was as far as generating returns. That still depends on the underlying assets. So at any point in time, it's about asymmetry in information. If a certain investor can have more or do more with the information available than the next, it creates a competitive advantage only until it becomes table stakes. So in this evolution right now of increased data from GPs to LPs, you know, what percent of LPs do you think are using it to create a competitive advantage and be better investors? And when do you see it becoming just table stakes? Either you do this or you don't exist.
I think we're getting pretty close to that point of it being table stakes. I think it's going to be really difficult to, you know, invest with confidence, create a program, execute effectively, and generate the sort of returns that will allow you to, you know, continue to commit to the private market. So I really do think we're there. We're very, very close. But I think in terms of the, you know, notion of how many are really taking full advantage of what could be, you know, competitive advantage, it's a little bit difficult to say. And I think it's hard to tie, you know, the availability of data, the analysis of that data through to performance, in part because there's a long time horizon for these things, and in part because there are so many other factors at play. What I think we can say pretty definitively is that investors are able to craft programs that are even better suited to their particular risk appetites and fit even more effectively within their broader investment program as a result of this data. So if you think about all the activities that center on, you know, risk management and being able to look through the portfolio to the individual holding basis and then make decisions, not just within the private markets sleeve, but from a total portfolio perspective, I think, you know, the opportunity set and then what's being done there is very different than it was even 5, 7, definitely 10 years ago. And I think all of that ultimately will flow through to better investment results. Now, whether those are, you know, higher net returns. I hope so. I think so. We'll see. But I think programs that are more tailored to the institution's specific objectives, I think we're seeing more of that, and that will only continue.
Yeah. You know, as we discussed earlier, you know, this industry has evolved rapidly over the last couple of decades. And I think one of the evolutions we're seeing now and a lot of change and innovation happening is in the world of secondaries. And I don't think that's uncorrelated to what we've just been talking about as far as more information and transparency, which leads to more liquidity. And, you know, secondaries itself has evolved to be one LP selling a stake to another LP, to GP-led restructurings, to preferred equity solutions. Now we're even seeing more GP stakes type of firms, which isn't even secondaries, but investments in the management company. And we've seen then LPs themselves, the large ones, have specialized teams focusing on this. We've seen funds being raised that specialize in any part of the value chain of secondaries. What is ILPA seeing and doing related to this evolution of private equity?
Yeah, I think at the highest level, you know, looking at those developments in aggregate, I mean, it's a real positive for the industry. I mean, the liquidity options that presents, the price discovery, the transparency that flows from those activities is all to the good from an industry perspective, and you know, more narrowly from the LP perspective, the ability to manage programs in different and creative ways, having more options available. I think that, you know, that can only be viewed through a positive lens. The flip side of that equation is that some of these types of strategies, specific transactions, come with their own set of considerations, right? And there's the opportunity embedded in some of these situations for misalignment of interests, failure to communicate effectively. And so what we've been trying to do over the past few years is identify those areas in which a gap could open up between LP and GP interests, between communication shortfalls, and how do we seek to address some of that preemptively, so that everyone feels like that spirit of partnership is retained, and that we've sort of provisioned for all these types of situations, and that's not easy. And I think, you know, that continues to be a learning experience for LPs and GPs alike. But it's a, you know, it's a good thing on the whole for the industry. And I think we'll see more of that. And we've spent a lot of time over the past year and a half, 2 years on GP stake sales and talking about those issues. I think that will continue. And I would expect the industry is going to continue to be highly creative and innovative and thinking about other variations of these types of transactions, and, you know, no shortage of interesting things to talk about as a result.
Yeah. You know, switching gears for a second here, talking about the members of ILPA, you know, institutional limited partners, you have insurance companies, pensions, endowments. The nature of LPs and private equity continues to evolve as well. And over the summer, the DOL put out a letter, you know, highlighting the access for retail investors into private equity. And there's a lot of excitement about what that might mean. Nothing immediately, but possibly for the future. And as we see, you know, an increase in the defined contribution pension plans versus defined benefit. How do you think that affects the LP community? And how do you see that mix changing over time, and what time frame?
Yeah, I think it's a really important industry issue for the industry, and something that, you know, in some ways is already here. But that whole notion of the democratization of private equity, the entry of more retail capital, I mean, we've seen a lot of that already. I mean, it's no small sum has been raised already through some of those channels, and I think the expectation should be that there will be more of that. So, you know, from the LP perspective, there are a couple of things I think that are really important to continue to consider and evaluate. I mean, at the simplest level, you know, those pools represent enormous sums of capital, and so what does that mean? If we see a 50% increase, a 200% increase in terms of money coming in to the private markets, what does that mean for return expectations going forward? What does that mean for access to particular managers for the vehicles that might be created to help invest that money? So I think there are a whole host of things that relate to just the inflow of capital, the scale of additional money that could influence the industry. I think, too, it's important to consider what that means from a regulatory perspective. And I think it would be hard to argue that, you know, the introduction of more retail money doesn't place even higher stakes on some of the issues that the industry has wrestled with for a number of years in terms of governance and transparency and reporting. And I think it's reasonable to forecast that regulators will want to continue to devote even more of their time and likely oversight of the market in those areas. So I think you could paint that in a variety of ways. If we wanted to take the optimistic view, I think some of those areas where the industry has the opportunity to tune up its practices, there will be pressure to tune up those practices if we're letting in 401k investors, retirees in more of an individual way. So that's a really interesting area to keep an eye on.
Yeah, it also highlights interesting paradox, if you will. There's all this excitement from LPs, who are ultimately the clients of private equity, about access to more private equity, increasing allocation to private equity. But private equity as an industry in the media has been a popular target to go after as well. Right? And, I've spoken with individuals who, are beneficiaries of pensions who don't even appreciate how much of their pension is going towards that industry and how much more needs to go there in order to meet the obligations in the future. What does the LP community think of this disconnect? Is there anything ILPA is doing to help, the broader world understand private equity's role?
Yeah, we're certainly trying to. And I'd say, the scrutiny that private equity is seeing on sort of an industry image level is significant and not likely to decrease anytime soon. So there's a premium on proactive, ongoing engagement with stakeholders, whether that's policymakers, policy shapers, frankly, the press, as you say, Abhi, the beneficiaries of these pools of capital and the communities that we touch via our investment activities. I mean, all of that needs more time and attention and more sort of proactive leadership from GPs and LPs alike in explaining private equity as an asset class. I do think that there are two sort of obvious areas under that general heading where private equity has the chance to act differently, to set an example, to lead in a different way moving forward. And those won't come as a surprise to you or anyone listening, but I think diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's not just a 2020 phenomenon. And that's something that we need to really spend more time as an industry on. And ESG, I think those two areas are sort of key pillars from an industry reputation perspective that are going to require a different level of discussion and frankly, action moving forward.
That's exactly what I want to talk about next. NASDAQ came out earlier this week and asked for guidance from the SEC about making it mandatory to have diversity and inclusion on boards of companies that list. Earlier this year, the DOL put out a memo about whether institutional LPs should be considering ESG at the cost of financial returns, right? Maybe not appreciating that they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. And these changes ultimately have to be driven by customers. And we've seen that across industries in the last couple of years where customers demand different behavior from the people they buy goods and services from. Similarly, for LPs, if they say they want this, GPs have to do it. That's their customer. But how do LPs weigh diversity, inclusion, ESG versus financial returns?
Yeah, I think there isn't a line in my mind between those two things. As you say, they're not mutually exclusive pursuits. I think that there's a very strong case to be made, and a large body of evidence that's emerged that both diversity, equity, and inclusion, and at a fundamental level, the risk management that's at the core of ESG, those are contributors, positive or negative, to investment outcomes. And we ignore or underappreciate those at our peril, and peril from investment results perspective. So setting aside sort of institution specific views on the individual issues, it seems to me that these are central themes in the evolution of the private equity industry if we want to continue to attract the sort of talent that will allow us to continue to generate these returns, if we are going to frankly protect the operating model and our license, so to speak, to invest in the way that we do. I just think we need to, if we haven't already, sort of moved beyond the conversation around, the sacrifice or compromise that might be inherent in these things, and try and get to a different plane on the discussion.
Maybe the last thing we can discuss is COVID, right? And how the world has changed. And coming out is, what do you think are the positive permanent changes you expect to see in the GPLP dynamic, and even with the role ILPA plays in the world?
Yeah, and I think the first thing to say is, whatever follows in terms of the commentary here, it's not in any way, shape, or form meant to minimize what have been severe challenges and loss that we've experienced this year. So I want to say that up front, really clearly. By the same token, I think that there's reason to be encouraged by how the industry has navigated the pandemic, and I think in some ways it has positively reinforced that LP-GP relationship. I think we've seen sort of the spirit of partnership shine through in a lot of ways this year. Folks have worked really hard on communication, making themselves available, providing timely reporting, being willing to get beyond just the standard deliverable in order to ensure that everyone is up to speed on where things stand in that moment. So we've made some tangible gains, I think, this year as a result, but we need to hold on to those. I think that spirit, there's an opportunity for us to build on that further. So that's one. I think that there are some patterns of interaction, some patterns of engagement between LPs and GPs, which we should make sure we don't lose sight of. In that same general neighborhood, I think we have proven our collective ability to interact effectively with one another without necessarily, hopping on that plane, hopping on that train, spending 200 nights a year in a hotel. And so that's not to suggest for a moment that, plenty of us aren't eager to get back out there interacting face to face. And I'm sure that time will come. But I think it will be good for all of us to reflect on pace of our efforts, sustainability of our efforts, how we can leverage technology, even when there's the possibility of getting back on the road more often. I think there are a whole host of really good reasons for us to consider, some changes in that regard, because I think that we've proven there are some things we can do differently that aren't just reactive, but actually put us in a better position going forward. So I think all of that has been a positive for the industry, and I hope we hold on to a whole bunch of that.
Agreed. Well, Steve, I want to thank you for spending the time today to speak with me. It's been very enlightening, and also thank you for the great work you, your team, and ILPA are doing to really advance and push the industry forward.
Very kind of you, Abhi. It's great to be here. Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
And with that, we come to the end of this episode of the Trust Vista Talk podcast. Thank you to our listeners, and we would love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review wherever you access podcasts. Please follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter to stay updated on additional content. To know more about how we support our clients on due diligence, business development, portfolio management, fund administration, data analytics, and other areas, feel free to visit our website and reach out to us at www.resista.com. Any information, opinions, and recommendations presented by our speakers are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of their firms or Resista and should not be constituted as investment advice.